It's 7 o'clock in New York City at 99.5 FM WBAI and WBAI.org on the web. Coming up next, what's going on with Rebecca Miles?
Hey, what's up now?
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
There's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying.
You know we've got to find a way to bring some love and pimp here today.
Picket lines and picket signs. Punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.
And good morning. I'm Rebecca Miles. Welcome to the morning show. Today's weather is partly cloudy, currently 64 degrees, with a high of 73 degrees Fahrenheit, chances of rain 10%, it feels like 64 degrees, humidity's 87%, winds of west-southwesterly are 3 miles per hour, and visibility is 10 miles. On the show this morning, we'll explore the United States Postal Office and the fight over its future, and whether it will stay a government agency or whether corporate lobbyists will succeed in turning it into a private business, and what you've been thinking about it when so many have been ordering online and not visiting stores during the pandemic. Have you been thinking about the postal workers and those who deliver your packages? We'll be joined on the show by Dr. Christopher Shaw, who's written a substantial book called First Class, the United States Postal Service, Democracy and the Corporate Threat. And later in the second half of the show, we'll be joined by a postmistress who runs the Davis Park Post Office, which is really a community hub, with her dog, Sally. So welcome to the show. And we'll just go now to some national news.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The issue before the Supreme Court is very specifically about that procedural question: should the Attorney General have been allowed to intervene at such a late stage after the court had already struck down the law twice, or did the Sixth Circuit get it right and he shouldn't have been allowed to intervene?
Attorney Heather Getnarek with the ACLU of Kentucky explains oral arguments the Supreme Court heard yesterday involving a 2018 Kentucky abortion law that bans a medical abortion method used after 15 weeks of pregnancy. The issue before the court involves the role of the state's Republican Attorney General, Daniel Cameron. The House on Tuesday cleared legislation to raise the debt limit into early December, ensuring that the nation doesn't default on its debts next week. The temporary measure will only offer lawmakers a brief reprieve from the partisan impasse. Another stopgap measure to fund the government also expires on December 3rd. Former President Barack Obama will campaign with Virginia Democratic gubernatorial candidate Terry McAuliffe, who is in a tight race with Republican Glenn Youngkin. Obama will join McAuliffe on October 23rd in Richmond. Americans' trust in President Biden has eroded as they've slowed their expectations for how quickly they can get back to their pre-pandemic lives, according to a new Axios Ipsos poll. The survey specifically measured Americans' trust in Biden to provide them with accurate information on COVID-19. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
We don't get too glum around here. Even if things look challenging, our view and his view is that he was elected to continue to press forward and address the challenges the American people are facing.
The California Department of Justice has opened an investigation into the oil spill that occurred off Huntington Beach this month. California Attorney General Rob Bonta said authorities from his office will work to determine the cause of the spill and what could have been done to prevent it. U.S. Coast Guard Officer Steve Stromer talked about restoring birds that were damaged from the oil spill.
They have their own room. They're especially quiet in there, so we're trying to get them healthy and back on the beach as soon as we can.
ICE agents will no longer conduct mass raids on workplaces where undocumented immigrants are employed, according to a new order by Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. Finally, more than 135 people were arrested outside the White House protesting a climate emergency and calling for the end to fossil fuel projects.
This is our stolen land!
Land. More climate protests are planned in Washington throughout the week as part of a mobilization dubbed People vs. Fossil Fuels. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Thank you to Nadia Ramlagan for some of the national news. And the other news item I saw that the borders between Canada and Mexico, which have been closed for 19 months for non-essential travel, are now open so families can reconnect and see loved ones. And that's some good news. Turning to local news, a jury's been selected for the trial of Lev Parnas, a one-time associate of Rudy Giuliani, who's accused along with co-defendant of making illegal campaign contributions. Opening statements are set for this morning. U.S. prosecutors say Parnas ingratiated himself with the influential Republicans through improper contributions. Those included a $325,000 donation in 2018 to a committee supporting then-President Donald Trump. Parnas initially came to public attention for his involvement in Giuliani's efforts to get the government of Ukraine to investigate the son of President Joe Biden. In other news, a federal judge has ruled that New York must continue to allow healthcare workers to seek exemptions from a statewide COVID-19 vaccine mandate on religious grounds as a lawsuit challenging the requirement proceeds. Judge David Hurd in Utica had issued a temporary restraining order a month ago after 17 doctors, nurses, and other health professionals claimed in a lawsuit that their rights would be violated with a vaccine mandate that disallowed the exemptions. The New York healthcare workers said their faith prevents them from accepting any of the 3 major vaccines distributed in the U.S. because the drug companies behind them relied on the use of fetal cell lines harvested from aborted fetuses in the 1970s and 1980s. They said abortion violates their religious principles. And a project to build a rail link connecting New York City to LaGuardia Airport has been put on hold after criticism. The Port Authority of New York and New Jersey said Tuesday it is pausing the project to consider alternatives. New York Governor Kathy Hochul has criticized the project, which was championed by her predecessor, Andrew Cuomo. The Federal Aviation Administration issued environmental approval in July, but recently had asked the Port Authority to reconsider in light of a lawsuit filed by neighborhood and environmental groups. The roughly $2 billion project was to build a 1.5-mile elevated link, and it was scheduled to begin this year. In healthcare news, there are cautions regarding aspirin from an influential health guidelines group. They say older adults without heart disease shouldn't take daily low-dose aspirin to prevent a first heart attack or stroke. Bleeding risks for adults in their 60s and up who haven't had a heart attack or stroke outweigh any potential benefits from aspirin. And in Star Trek news, as William Shatner prepares to be beamed up at the age of 90 for his first real-life space flight today, he's bringing out the awe in a handful of people around a rural Texas spaceport. The mayor of Van Horn, Texas, the nearest town to where Shatner will become the oldest to be launched into space, says it's about time the Star Trek star made a trip for real. And finally, serious concerns over recent privatization changes to retiree health care, along with deficits in health and safety pandemic protocols, have galvanized both retirees and in-service UFT members. They will rally today outside the UFT Shanker Hall to support a resolution on healthcare plan changes, current and future, to be presented inside the first delegate assembly of the year. You can join retirees, parents and students and community organizations supported of the resolution from 3:30 to 6:30 at 52 Broadway in Manhattan outside the UFT central offices. It's now 7:10. Today's weather is partly cloudy, currently 64 degrees with a high of 73 degrees Fahrenheit. Chances of rain, 10%. It feels like 64 degrees Fahrenheit. Humidity is 87%. Winds are west-southwesterly at 3 miles per hour. Visibility is 10 miles. So joining me on the show this morning is historian and policy analyst Christopher W. Shaw, whose new book, First Class, the U.S. Postal Service, Democracy and the Corporate Theft, illuminates the history of the U.S. Postal Service by exposing the various campaigns against it and how the current attacks have implications that go beyond the future of mail service and will have consequences for American democracy if they're not stopped. Welcome to the show, Christopher Shaw.
Last night, as I got home, about a half past ten, there was the woman I thought I knew in the arms of another man. I kept my cool, I ain't no fool. Let me tell you what happened then. I packed some clothes and I walked out, and I ain't going back again. So take a letter, Maria, address it to my wife. Say I won't be coming home, gotta start a new life. We'll take a letter, Maria, address it to my wife. Send a copy to my lawyer, gotta start a new life. You've been many things, but most of all, a good secretary to me. And it's times like this I be.
And that was Letter to Maria by R.B. Graves. Welcome back to What's Going On. I'm the host, Rebecca Miles, and this is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Joining me on the show this morning is historian and policy analyst Christopher W. Shaw. I believe he's on the line. Hello, Christopher.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. I know it's very early for you in California, and I'm very grateful you were able to join us. Christopher's new book is First Class, the U.S. Postal Service, Democracy and the Corporate Threat, which illuminates the history of the U.S. Postal Service by exposing the various campaigns against it and how the current attacks have implications that go beyond the future of mail service and will have consequences for American democracy if they're not stopped. Christopher Shaw is an author, historian, and policy analyst. He has a PhD from the University of California, Berkeley, and is the author of Money, Power, and the People, The American Struggle to Make Banking Democratic, and the current book, as I mentioned, First Class. Welcome to the show this morning.
Glad to be here with you. Thank you for having me.
Not at all. So this is a fascinating book. I wanted to ask, perhaps we could start with where we are currently. There's a lot of discussion around this Postal Service Reform Act of 2021. What would this do to the current services that we have?
Well, the proposed legislation would relieve a unique burden, financial burden, that is on the Postal Service that is responsible for really almost all of its financial problems that make it pre-fund its retiree health benefits decades into the future. So that's the main provision, and it would remove that burden from the Postal Service.
So that this was a change that was enacted in 2006, where the post office was having to fund pensions going out to 75 years of its going out that far, basically amassing billions of dollars to make sure that the pension was covered. This was only with the post office. There were no other government agencies that had this requirement. That's right, right?
Yeah, that's right. The standard for funding something like this is it's a kind of a pay-as-you-go model where it's 10 to 15 years into the future. But the 2006 law funded retiree health care costs out over 50 years into the future at $4 to $5 billion a year. And this is a very aggressive payment schedule. No other government agency does it. No private corporation tries to do it. The idea of it was to correct an overpayment. So the Postal Service, it was discovered, had actually overpaid into its retiree health fund. And returning this money to the Postal Service would increase the federal budget deficit, because the federal budget is a separate pool of money from the Postal Service. So these funds are put in escrow account, and this accelerated prepayment plan was created. And it is close to 90% of the Postal Service losses are due to pre-funding this retiree health benefits fund.
So when they say that the post office is, you know, facing, you know, financial crisis, are you really saying that it's a manufactured financial crisis?
That's right. The finances would look very different if it were not for this pre-funding requirement. And that's really the major issue here. And also it's essentially a paper loss. This is it goes on the ledger, but this is not actually about operating income, about the cash flow the Postal Service has, which is looks comparatively really quite good. In fact, the task force that the Trump administration led found that the Postal Service was actually showing net revenue in most years, up to $1 billion per year, if you would remove the pre-funding requirement.
Right. That's contrary to what you see reported. So that's very interesting. Now, the Postal Service, you know, well, we'll open up the calls later for listeners. The first question I'm going to ask is, you know, when was the last time you went to the post office? But what I read, didn't realize until I read your book, is how reliant small businesses, which make up like 99% of American businesses, rely on the post office in order to, you know, get their products to people, to send out their mailers. That seems to sort of be lost in all of these discussions. When you try and see it competing against UPS and FedEx, the actual services provide are much more substantial.
That's right. The Postal Service provides a lot of services that no private business would provide, and it can do this because it's a government agency, because it's a public service. And in the case of small businesses, they can't necessarily go and negotiate to get a good deal with a discount from a private company like UPS. So they turn to the Postal Service and patronize local post offices. And that does give them a certain competitive advantage that they would lack if they were to go up against large companies in the delivery market. So the Postal Service, it provides coast to coast and into Alaska and Hawaii. It provides universal service in all of these areas, no matter how remote they are, and it serves everybody. It doesn't matter if you're, mailing 50 items or one item. We all get served by the Postal Service, and that's the principle, the idea of democratic public service that serves everyone uniformly and does this on a universal basis that encompasses the whole nation.
Now, I also understand when the post office first created, almost, I mean, we're coming, 245 years ago, that one of the sort of major developments was these postal roads. So suddenly, like, people were starting to be connected through the building of roads to be able to get the post to a town. Is that my correct understanding of it?
Yes, the post office had a major role in connecting and linking the country together. And to this day, its mission is to bind the nation together. And you can see that right from the very start. And this mission was put above the idea of profit. So the colonial post office had its mission. It was trying to actually make a profit. The American post office stops trying to do this. It tries to fulfill other goals that have to do with public service, that have to do with binding people together. And especially at the beginning, and this is still important today, but very important at the beginning, was the idea that it would help to inform the citizens. So this new Republican government, citizens needed to be informed. They needed to receive news. They needed to know about public affairs. And the Postal Service existed as a network that allowed this news to be disseminated throughout the nation. It didn't matter if you were in a more remote area or a more settled area. The idea was they would all have access to news, and this was due to carrying news at a very, very affordable postage price through the post office.
Right. So we're just going to take a musical break in just now. If listeners have got any calls, questions for Christopher Shaw about the history of the post office, but also its relevance today, the number to call is 212-209-2877. If you've just tuned in, I'm the host of What's Going On this morning on WBAI 99.5 FM. My name's Rebecca Miles, and I'm joined on the show by Christopher Shaw, who's the author and historian and policy analyst. And we're talking about his new book, First Class, the U.S. Postal Service, Democracy and the Corporate Threat. We'll just take a little musical break and we'll be back to you after. We're going to listen now to Stevie Wonder, Signed, Sealed and Delivered, I'm Yours. And that was Signed, Sealed and Delivered, I'm Yours by Stevie Wonder. I understand that we have a few callers on the line. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
What's your name and where are you calling from?
This is D'Italiano from Riverdale.
Hi, D'Italiano from Riverdale. Welcome to the show. Do you have a question for the guest? Sorry, Christopher Shaw.
Question and no comment. I think that many people's better wake up and get the NLRB busy and start unionizing everything, everywhere. Because what's going on is that there's a global treaty going on to just break companies all up and just make it open market and people buying companies that are foreign, American people going abroad and buying companies, people coming here, many institutions. And what happens is that maybe with the post office, it'd be a little tough to break it up and sell it to a foreign company. But what'll happen is an American company will buy it, and I see them outsourcing all kinds of jobs that within the post office, if it gets that far. And this is going on with other companies, outsourcing. So they better start unionizing people. You know, that secretary who didn't care about union work and that construction guy over there or the fireman. We should start a mass unionization everywhere. And, yes, there were union problems even at WBAI.
Yes, there were. Actually, Christopher, perhaps this is an interesting point that the caller brings up, because, of course, there have been two examples of where you privatized part of it. There was the commercial airlines that was, you mentioned in the book, and that would be the one example, and also postal services in other countries. What happened in Switzerland, what happened in Britain, when the government got involved and decided to either privatize it or sell off services, and also what has happened to Greyhound buses. You give these examples in the book. Perhaps you could talk about what we might take from the illustration of what happened to those services.
That's right, yeah, and the caller on Riverdale, too. The Postal Service has really been a target of the pro-corporate forces that would like to privatize the Postal Service. It's kind of a crown jewel in many ways because it's such a vast organization. And so privatization and deregulation of the postal market has occurred in a lot of other nations, although not in this one. And what you see when that occurs is that the level of service goes down. The rural areas don't get delivery as much. The number of days that mail is delivered is decreased. Post offices are closed, et cetera. And so this is what happens with privatization, is you see that service reduction, because now the goal is not public service. The goal is turning a profit. And you can see also with the deregulation of a market that had previously been regulated. So that's something that in this country we have experience with, as you said, in the airline industry, also in the passenger bus industry, where once deregulation occurred, the number of places that are served is going to be reduced because the profitability is not there in the same way. Essentially, all these industries that have large transportation networks, there are profitable parts and there are non-profitable parts. And the profitable parts are used to subsidize the non-profitable ones. And that's what allows for a universal network where everybody is served. But once profit becomes the goal, rather than providing a public service, then at that point, they begin to shut down the non-profitable parts of it, and people lose that service. And so we have seen that with airports, smaller airports losing all commercial airline service. We have seen that with smaller towns losing passenger bus service in this country. And we'd see a similar process if we were to deregulate the postal market and privatize the postal service. And in other countries that have decided to go down that road, that is indeed what we have seen happen.
What is the threat of privatization likely? Is this a constant concern?
There is a constant drum roll from a lot of forces in Washington, D.C., certain think tanks like the Heritage Foundation, for instance, that they would like to see privatization happen. And so this is constantly something that's being raised, that the post office is inefficient, it doesn't work well, and if only it could be run like a private business, then everything would be so much better. But if you actually look beyond this theory to the reality of what has happened when this kind of action has been taken in other parts of the world, then what you see is that it ceases being a public service that we can rely on, that we depend upon in our daily lives, and instead it becomes something else entirely. And that is a business where the bottom line is the most important thing. And we can know at that point that those services are going to be reduced and diminished and degraded.
Mm. I believe we have one more call for our guest today, Christopher Shaw. Hello, caller, you're on air.
Yes, thank you very much. This is Brother David from Brooklyn, and I am calling to really celebrate the post office. I grew up in the Depression, and my father was one of the lucky ones that had a job as a clerk in a post office. And I'm very thankful for that. And it went on to provide jobs for my brothers. And my brother, one of my brothers, John, became postmaster of New York some years ago. I see this as one of the destructive things that neoliberalism is doing. Neoliberalism is trying to turn everything that is public into private for private property. So it's very simple. And that's what's happening with the post office. And we cannot allow that to happen. So I'm hopeful that people will wake up and stop this train that's going towards neoliberalism for everything that is public and turning it into private.
Thank you very much for that, caller, and wonderful that you had this long legacy going back to the Depression with the post office. And I actually, when you read the book, that's what comes out, this sort of constancy of it. It's rather like the ocean. It's always there. And it's also bigger than that. Joining us on the show this morning as well is a postmistress, who Linda Firpo, who's the postmistress of Davis Park Post Office on Fire Island, New York. She's open for 2 months of the year. The mail is ferried across the Great South Bay. She's a longtime Long Island girl. She's a nurse and an attorney and now a retiree. And she took on the post office to keep the tradition going. She's the third long-term postmistress. She was preceded by Ethel Shand, who started it in 1955 and followed by Doris Falvey for more than 20 years. Linda took over in 2006. The post office is also a library and is the social hub of the island. Besides getting mail and sending mail, there are all sorts of community connections. The Community Rehabilitation and Beautification Committee magnets and mugs are for sale, and the fire department T-shirts are also available, and as are books from local authors, postcards, and lots of friendly, smiling conversation. And there's the mascot dog, Sally, who's always willing to be petted. And for the brave one, there's free advice. And also Lost and Found. And Linda says nobody should come to Davis Park without stopping by the post office and library. Welcome to the show this morning, Linda Firpo.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So tell me about a day in the life of a postmistress.
Well, I usually get there earlier than opening time, and I like to set everything up for the day, get my cash drawer ready, my stamp assortment ready. Open up the windows, get the breeze flowing through because it's not air conditioned. And then I just like to just watch everybody come off the ferry, passing the post office on the way to the beach and passing the post office again on the way off the beach back to the ferry.
And how does the mail arrives on the ferry? How much are you dealing with weight-wise?
Okay, every day the ferry owner, Matthew Sherman, goes to the Patchogue Post Office and picks up a huge locked mail bag, which he hands to the captain of the ferry, who then has to hand deliver it to me. It has a locked serial number on it, which I cut, which proves the mail has not been tampered with. I understand that the ferry driver who handles the mail is actually drug tested by the United States Postal Service. So I get the mail in every day, and I use that same large postal bag to make an outgoing mail bag of the people's mail that's outgoing. And every day we do an exchange like that.
Are there a lot of rules? I mean, you've just mentioned three or four that you have to pay attention to. Is it kind of daunting, the number of things that you, you know, the number of rules and regulations you have to follow?
Yes, it is. I've had to take courses from the United States Postal Service. For example, they had a representative come down and give me an active shooter in service. And then I've had to take in services about what can safely be transported in the mail, like when lithium batteries can go, when they have to be in the laptop, how many can go in a bag, all sorts of safety regulations about what can be transported through the United States Postal Service. And for me, it's not something I do every day. It's something I do 3 months out of the year. So I'm always refreshing myself on these rules, as well as the postal rates, which change sometimes when I'm not in session at the post office. So I come back and have to learn, you know, what the new postal rates are, what the new priority and express mail rates are, certified mail, return receipt, requested fees, all of that.
So what's the average purchase at the Davis Park post office?
Well, I'm very lucky because the community supports me. So a lot of the businesses will buy large amounts of stamps, and people will gather together and buy a large amount of stamps to make sure I sell my inventory out so that I'm successfully a good post office for the Postal Service. I've had people buy over hundreds of dollars worth of rolls of stamps. The fire department spends at least $150 a season doing their mailings, as does the church and some of the real estate agents on the island. So I'm very lucky to have the community support. In fact, without the community support, the post office would fizzle.
So, yeah, what is the... If you, is it that you don't, if you don't show a profit, are you, is there a likelihood that this, that the future of the post office could be affected?
Well, they must look at the postal sales. Now, I always sell out my inventory, which starts at 3,000, and I'll usually sell $4,000 worth of stamps in a season. But I would imagine if I had a season where I didn't sell my postage, they would wonder, well, what do you need it for? Why do you need a post office there? You know, it would show a lack of need, but I always sort of outdo my needs. So I'm very confident that I wouldn't be selected as one of the low performers that need to be closed because of, you know, low utilization rates.
Now, this post office really goes beyond that. You've collaborated with the Patchogue Library. You're now doing storytelling for the children at the weekends. What else are you doing? Of course, I mentioned in the opening, you sell fire department T-shirts. You've got magnets and mugs. You know, what else are you? You're really a community hub.
Yeah, we really try to be everything. I've had a great lost and found there. I get cell phones, iPads, expensive items, sometimes full wallets with cash and credit cards, and I get these things back to the people that lost them. I've sent postcards to people's homes letting them know something they lost is at the post office. Now, the library part works with the Patchogue Library to do story time for the children. We've also had book signings. We've also had one of the artists do children crafts. It's been very, very, very nicely growing. And the head of the DPA has always been very, very receptive to new ideas, no red tape, no obstacles in the way. So it's been an excellent experience for me working with the community.
Now, you're a retiree. So how important is this to your own person, to you yourself? You know, what do you get out of it?
Well, it is really a labor of love because the stipend that the post office pays doesn't really cover the expenses for being there, my postal bond, the transportation back and forth. So you have to really do it out of a labor of love. And I think that's why most of the time the people that handled this were retired people. And I can see why that is. It becomes, the more you enjoy it, the more you do, and it becomes consuming, but it's a labor of love.
Mm. So I'm just wondering if there are any callers with listeners with questions for Linda Firpo, who's the postmistress of Davis Park Post Office. And we still have of course, Christopher Shore on the line. Christopher, I don't know if you have any questions for Linda.
I mean, it's been an education listening to hear about this, and very glad to hear about everything that's going on there at that post office.
Well, thank you very much. You know, there are some funny things that have happened to me. My post office is actually an unair-conditioned little sort of a shack that's boarded up in the winter and, of course, cleaned in the spring from, you know, rodents and things that end up in there over the winter. But one time I asked the Postal Service for an American flag. They sent me a flag that was larger than the roof of the building because it was intended, I guess, for a regular post office building. So some of the signage that they send me, if I put it into the building that I'm working in, I wouldn't be able to get into the doorway myself. So some of the things have to really be adjusted for the tiny, tiny space that I occupy.
I'm just going to give a weather break. So you're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM. You're listening to What's Going On. I'm the host, Rebecca Miles. Today's weather is partly cloudy, currently 64 degrees, with a high of 73 degrees, chances of rain 10%. Feels like 64 degrees Fahrenheit. Humidity is 87%. Winds west southwesterly, 3 miles per hour. Visibility is 10%, 10 miles. Welcome back to the show. We have no callers. The number to call is 212-209-2877. We've just been listening to Linda Firpo, who's the postmistress for Davis Park Post Office. And we also have on the line Christopher Shore, who's the author and historian and has a new book coming out called First Class, the U.S. Postal Service, Democracy and the Corporate Threat. I wonder, Christopher, if we could go back to you. One of the things I was curious about is the post office used to be deliver banking services. Then this was changed. And now there are attempts to bring back banking service. This is, of course, for Americans who don't have access to banks or don't trust them. There's like 1 in 4 American households is unbanked and half of all black households don't use banks. And there's a pilot program underway which gives gift cards based on payroll and business checks, and they're being up at ones in the Bronx, Washington, D.C., Baltimore and Falls Church in Virginia. What's going on with this desire to use the post office to create some sort of banking system?
Well, they're bringing back what was done before. For most of the 20th century, the post office operated a savings bank, so you could walk into your local post office and open a savings account. And it was a place where people felt that their money was secure. It had at certain points billions of dollars in on deposit there. And the bankers always did not want it to exist. They lobbied against its creation in the first place, and then they lobbied against its continued existence. And then in the 1960s, they successfully lobbied it out of existence. So that's why we don't have it today. But as you point out, there are lots of people who do not actually have a bank account, and this makes it a lot more difficult in today's society to get by without the access to those kinds of services. It means that you have to depend on places like check cashing outlets and payday lenders and pawn shops that charge a lot of money to do simple things like just cash a check. So there's this new pilot program. And as you say, one place that's started, it's only in 4 post offices right now, but one is in the Bronx and in Baychester. And you can cash a payroll check or a business check onto a gift card for $5.95. And this is just the beginning of starting to be able to get some banking services back. That's the idea, to get them back in the post office. And the great thing about the post office is that they're located, like Linda Firpo was telling us, in all kinds of communities all around America. And so it's right there at hand and easy to access. And so it's a good place for these banking services to be located at. And this is seen as a pilot program, and it could be expanded in the future. Some of the things they're thinking about is putting no-fee ATMs inside post offices so you can use your card there to get cash that way. Also, domestic money transfers, where you can move money from one post office to another. And then bill payment services as well. So this is all an effort to try to include people into the financial system. And the post office is really an agency that can make this happen. So it's an exciting prospect going forward to expand this public service and allow it to serve more Americans and to serve Americans in a new way, although it was something that the post office did in the past.
Mm. I believe we have a few more callers. Welcome to the show. Where are you calling from? What's your name and where are you calling from?
Good day. My name is Frida Panthers. I'm calling from Brooklyn, New York. My question is concerning stamps, black stamps, Heroes and so forth. They have not been available at the post office. I find they have not been available at many post offices throughout New York City. You know, whenever I travel through out the boroughs, Long Island and so forth, I find that I always try to go to the post office to get stamps, black stamps of Heroes, and it's usually not available. Can you tell me why?
Christopher, do you know why?
Linda? I think Linda might be the one to answer this, but I know that I have had an experience when I would go into a post office and they're understocked. The orders were not made properly, so it's an unfortunate occurrence when it happens, but I know it does happen. But I don't, I don't operate a post office, but Linda does, so she might have some insight.
Yes, I do. Actually, a lot of my clients are from New York City. Then they vacation out on Eastern Long Island. And I have always had people coming to me asking me for extra postcard stamps and extra international stamps. And they'll tell me that their local city post office doesn't have them, which is surprising because they have the huge volume of customers there. So I don't really know the logistics for the normal post office. But for me, I have to put in a requisition for stamps. Oftentimes, I don't know what stamps will be available when I'm opening, so I will just put denomination numbers down and hope and ask them to please give me an assortment of pretty stamps so people have nice things to choose from. But it is a bit of a cumbersome procedure. You need to put in code numbers, and the ordering is quite a lot of paperwork, to be honest with you.
And I believe we have a few more callers. Hello, caller. You're on air. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Yes. This is Diane from the Bronx, and thank you for the topic.
Can you speak up, please?
Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
If you speak a bit louder, yes.
Okay. Yes. And the idea of the banking was what I was going to amen to. So they need to follow that up, and I'm going to look, because we're in the Bronx, it's fight and dive, and we certainly could use the banking, because they shut down our only Chase office. So I'm interested in that. And what was the other? That was the primary one. So thank you so much.
And thank you.
To find out who else is doing this in the Bronx.
Who else is doing the pilot banking scheme?
Right. Because I think he mentioned Baychester, but we're in Spuyten Duyvil. We had a Chase Bank. You know, people could walk to it, and then they just closed it. But we do have a postal, outlet right around the corner. So I think we'd make an excellent candidate, you know, to have a pilot program there as well.
Ah, that's interesting, Chris. Did you hear the listener there?
I did, yeah. I mean, I think that there's a lot of good candidates in the Bronx. Unfortunately, for right now, just starting off, it's just in Baychester. But I think that there are a lot of good places for future banking services there in the Bronx. And hopefully it will open up and be made available at additional post offices in that borough and in other places in New York City and around the country.
Actually, this brings up something. So you've got a bank that closed. Suddenly there's no bank in the town. And this kind of service would be, just very helpful. Although It's for gift cards at the moment, but I was intrigued to listen to you talk about these ATMs with no fees. Good, that would be a godsend. But also there's been some considerations about the post office providing internet services and also running an email service. What are the details on those two proposals?
Well, one thing that seems to be pretty easy to get going is just to make wireless internet available, for instance, in the parking lots of post offices or in the lobbies of post offices, so that people could access the internet there very easily at their local post office. A more ambitious idea would be that the post office offer Americans email accounts. And this was something that was looked into and explored about 20 years ago when email was new. And there's no reason that it can't be looked at again. And it would have some benefits in terms of privacy, that the Postal Service has certain privacy regulations. And this would also apply if they were to offer email. And with these big tech corporations surveilling our messages in order to do targeted advertising and things like that, that is an issue that people are raising more and more with the existing email services that we use.
Right. I understand we have two more callers. Caller, you're on air. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Denise from Brooklyn. I just wanted to mention that we seem like the listeners in the public, the American people, have to keep in mind that this is a company. The post office provides excellent jobs, and it allows people to pay their taxes, and this is what runs this country. These corporations that want to take over the post office probably pays less than half of the post workers, the everyday workers, towards this country's, wealth. Also, the woman asked about, how can they get a bank in their particular community. We have to exercise our lobbying powers. We must do that now. Because if we don't start to use our lobbying powers, call your senator, call your congressman, start like that. For that woman that asked about who is to do to get that banking system in the post office in her immediate area, it is you that is supposed to do it. It's us. We have to protect our wealth. We can't allow a couple of rich corporations to take the wealth from the American people. We must speak up, and we must understand where the wealth of this country comes from the working people, our taxes. For that retired sister who said, Ms. Verpo, the reason why she's very animated, she happens to be a retired person that has an income that she can live on because the post office provides a good pension. We have to keep in mind, we have to keep these jobs in place, and we have to be creative. And if you feel the lady that's supposed to that wants to have the banking system in the post office in your immediate area, talk to your council person, talk to the people who are supposed to serve us, because these affluent companies are definitely getting their voice through. They are much more of us than they are of them. And we need to keep our post office. That is the American people's wealth. It belongs to us, not to a small corporation. I'm sorry to be so aggressive. And Ms. Miles, we're going to see about stopping all these breaks in between the conversation. It's very distracting. That's for the listener to say we don't need information about the weather and all this nonsense. We can get that from our phone. Listeners, open your voice as well. We have to keep our wealth, and WBAI is also a very, very important entity for communications and freedom of speech. Thanks.
I would just like to say one thing. Most of the people that operate postal services like I do are independent contractors. We have no postal benefits whatsoever, no sick time, no health insurance, nothing. It's just a straight 1099 form. I pay my own taxes. I have to take care of my own health insurance. And that's how it works with these small coastal postal units. They're such low-paying things that they don't even rebid the jobs each year. They just renew your contract because it would cost more money in mailing than they pay the person who's operating the system. So just to clarify that.
Great. And I'm afraid we've run out of time. Perhaps I won't give the weather next time. Thanks for the advice from the caller. I have to say thank you very much to my guest this morning, Linda Firpo, postmistress for Davis Park Post Office on Fire Island, New York, and Christopher Shaw, author and historian, of the new book coming out by in November, First Class, the U.S. Postal Service, Democracy and the Corporate Threat. There are wonderful details in there. Particularly, we didn't even cover the Depression and how the use of the Postal Service spread bulletins and information and newsletters and newspapers so that the public were informed about what was going on with the government, but also with their country. It had a whole role that played to the workers' protests and demands for better working conditions and pay. But thank you very much to my guests this morning. I'm the host, Rebecca Miles. This is What's Going On. Thank you to the engineer, Michael G. Haskins. And join me next Wednesday. Thank you and good morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Talk to me, brother. You can't see what's going on. Yeah, what's going on? Tell me what's going on. I'll tell you what's going on.
Right, right on. Right on.
It's 7:55 here in New York City, actually 7:56 on listener-sponsored WBAI. Tomorrow morning at 7 a.m., What's Going On with Felipe Luciano. But right now, coming up next, we have our local station board candidate statements, and right after that, Democracy Now!
This is WBAI New York. The election for the local station board is currently underway with 27 listener candidates.
I'm Harriet Hines. I recently ran for a city council seat. I would like to give back by using my knowledge of organizational psychology and grant writing to help the board strengthen the station. Through my activism, I will shed light on racial injustice by bringing forth awareness of the community/nation by opposing Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams and Councilman Matthew Eugene's developing housing on top of the African burial ground in Flatbush, Brooklyn. Please vote for me and the other Justice and Unity candidates.
My name is John Hoffman. I owe a lot to WBAI. I attribute much of my outlook on life to what I've learned by listening to the station. I want to be able to give back to the station that has given so much to me. And because I have extensive experience, I can offer in the finance and budgeting world, including being on the board of directors of my condo association. I want to help elevate the experience of the station and make sure it remains independent. I believe that building on the progress that has been made to stabilize the financial condition of the station is essential.
Come on, EA. This is Kim Ives. I'm a filmmaker and have worked in Haitian media for over 40 years, including WBAI's Haiti, The Struggle Continues, and Lambi Call. In general, WBAI must reengage, expand our listenership, and renew interest, faith, and passion in the station's programming and mission. We must modernize the delivery of our programs, incorporate video, and simplify and streamline sharing on social media. WBAI is invaluable.
I'm Sarah Kleppner from New Jersey, asking WBAI to love the Garden State back. Please elect me to the local station board so I can translate my enthusiasm into organized growth activity. Our station can help forge pathways for all humanity at a time of sharpening political, economic, and environmental challenges. I'm a social justice activist and an adult educator with an interest in listener engagement. We need a board committed to working together.
My name is Dean Lauren, and I'm running because of the merger and acquisition attack on Pacifica Foundation. And the current attack is based on a bankruptcy model using legal lawsuits to bleed the cash and force an FJC loan default. The FJC loan default will trigger a refinancing by the lender that is, I would not say clean, and that will secure the loan with Pacifica Station's assets.
To learn more about WBAI's local station board candidates and to vote in this election, visit elections.pacifica.org.
All ballots are due on Friday, October 15th. Make your voice heard.
Greetings, I'm Linda Perry, Program Director here at WBAI Radio. Join me and our station manager, Bertol Reimers, for a report to the listener. That's this Wednesday, October 13th from 3 to 5 p.m. We'll discuss the current state of the station.